I brought up and they've left me two here already. I got to get this stuff out of the road or we're going to have trouble. It's an Al-Anon convention. I had to think of something real quick because three of my jokes are gone already. It's a great job, but I used to imagine you're all naked. That's N-E-K-K-I-D, the way they say it down in South Georgia. Some of you look pretty damn good. But there are spa memberships available. My name is John Cornelius. I'm an alcoholic. I also have an alias. I'm Santa C. And we'll talk about that later. I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous since May 1st, 1968. That sounds real good, and thank you very much, but about a month ago on Sunday morning, I was at the freeway breakfast in Cleveland, Ohio, and I asked the guy beside me how long he had been in the program, and he looked at me and he said, 60 years this time. His family forced him in 1942, and he ran away from his family and AA both by joining the army, fighting and drinking all over Europe, got out, ran out of the 5220 club, and in 1946 got sober. I just sat there in awe and shut my mouth and listened. It was one strange table there. There was a 60-year, a 49-year, a 46, a 44, a 38, a 29, and a 20 at one table. And it's like, this is what it's all about. Now, I know we're geared to the newcomer, but our primary purpose is to stay sober. And I do that by going to meetings, working this program. I've been even known to go to some AFG meetings. I was one of those alcoholics that took the three-hour course behind the clubhouse and became an alcoholism counselor. A two-hat professional. And I tell you, if you deal with that many alcoholics, sick ones, y'all better get to an Al-Anon meeting and Gwen and be quiet. I've noticed two things being in Alcoholics Anonymous and going to an AFG meeting every now and then. And they are this. And since you're Al-Anon, you know this. Literally anybody can be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, anybody. Just looking around. But to be an Al-Anon, you have to know somebody. You can quote me on that one. I was born and raised on a little farm in the coal mining area of western Pennsylvania. My ancestors had come to America to dig coal, and that's what we were, just poor farm people. But everybody was poor, so we didn't realize it. You know, it was the Depression, and you just were poor. That was a state of being. Both my mama and daddy worked, and that meant that my brother and I did all the chores. I don't know how that affected me, but I found out in a retrospective moment, that both of my ex-wives couldn't cook or clean house. But I could. And I was a house husband with a full-time job outside, you know. And that was okay. I do believe in women's liberation. I've set two free. You might know the one. She's kind of famous. She's a test pilot in a broom factory. She inherited a job from her mama, and mama was a Quaker school teacher, and I was drinking one time, and she was thee-ing and thou-ing me. And you know, when you have all them holes, them psychic holes filled up, she thee-ed out and me one day, and I spoke some Quaker back to her. Screw thee. That got mentioned in the divorce, too. I'm looking at myself right now, and it's hard to believe, but I was extremely shy and bashful. I could not speak aloud in public. I couldn't do anything that normal children did. When somebody would say, let's do something, even though I knew it was wrong, I'd just go along with it because it was easier to go along than say no and have to explain. So I was a bad boy. I was worse than a bad one. I was a real bad boy. Somebody say, well, let's rob the such and such. Yeah, let's go. Let's burn down the woods. Yeah, I got matches, you know. Let's go. It's tough being a kid and not being able to talk. It's tough being a kid that is brought up in a very strict, pinched-faced Presbyterian atmosphere. And them pinched-faced Presbyterians I grew up around, they could say fun without showing their teeth. And I prayed to that God to set me free, to allow me to be like other kids, to allow me to recite in school, to allow me... God was still alive then, at least in schools, because we read the Bible every morning and prayed. And it came my turn to read the Bible, and the teacher said, you're going to do it. I stood up there and stood up there, and she says, you're going to stand there until you do it. Well, she was right. I did it. I peed my pants and threw up. I was never asked to speak again. Word went out ahead of me. Don't ask him to do anything. It smells bad. Clean up time. I got out of school. Let me digress here a little bit. I was found out early on that I was a natural swimmer. From age 4 on, I was in the water, and I was at home in the water. And by 9, I was a champion swimmer in the Amateur Athletic Union of Eastern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, and upstate New York. I was beating people 18, 19, 22 years old. Can't hear me. Can you hear me now? I was a swimmer, and I was a champion. And they were looking at me to go to the Olympics in 1956, and I couldn't do that. I was fearful, so I began smoking and breaking training and got kicked off the team. That's what fear did for me. And I kept praying to God for a release from this, and I never got it. And I kept listening to adults tell me what to do, and I'd do it, and it didn't work. And so I lost a lot of faith in everything. And I did end up going to college on a swimming scholarship, went in my hometown. Went to a little Presbyterian college, Bible thumpers and pinch-faced people. And they billed themselves as a small Christian college in a small Christian college town. I started drinking. They found out what a small Christian I was and kicked me out. They said, why don't you join the military and get straightened out and then come back? I made a mistake. I joined the Marine Corps to get straightened out in. There were some times I got so straight I couldn't move. I found other things when I was under the influence of fear. I was in a foxhole in Beirut, Lebanon in 1958. They're still fighting that damn war. I thought I'd finished it up for them, but I guess not. And I'm in a foxhole with a guy from Bedford-Stuyvesant, New York, and they're shooting at us, and I'm afraid, really afraid. And I said to my buddy, I said, Punch, are you afraid? And he says, no. I said, Punch, I'm afraid. Here, try this. I wasn't afraid anymore. I went over to them Arabs that were shooting at us and bought some more. You know, first things first, get your priorities in line. This stuff was good. Got out of the Marine Corps, went back to the same college, got kicked out again for drinking. I used to tell people I graduated magna cum laude twice. Then we had dating rituals back in the 50s and 60s. She would say something and you would say something back. And it was like code. She said something and I looked at her and said, you're what? And then we got married. Well, you know, opposites attract. She was pregnant. I wasn't. This was some of the saddest times of anybody's life, both of ours. 2 24-year-old spoiled brat children who had never grown up acting out adults. And we couldn't do it. The only trouble was we kept having kids, you know. We had one, had another one. She escaped. She escaped all the time. She's always going home. I was at work one day and a guy called me up and said, John, are you moving? I said, no. He said, you better go home. Somebody is. And I got there in time to see the moving van leaving out with everything. And I was sad, but I was also happy because that meant I could go drinking that night and not have to explain anything to anybody. And at the moment that that happened, I was the assistant to the president of a major agency in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And 2 weeks later, I was down on the near north side of Pittsburgh drinking out of brown paper wrapped bottles with the boys. I stepped right out of the big time and into street bum. And I became a move-along drunk, and I just moved along. Not by my own volition, some minion of the law would come and say, come with me, boy. Take me to the edge of the jurisdiction, usually hit me with something, and say, move along, drunk. I went to California and back twice, just moving along. I fell in with evil companions and had a wonderful time. I drank with Jack Kerouac. Those of you who have a couple of years on you know who Jack was. He wrote our manual. I ended up in Cleveland, Ohio, late April 1968. Sort of the end of the world. somebody gave me a job, and I couldn't. Okay. I tell you, when I was paranoid, we would have had trouble there with you coming that close to me with that look on your face. Watch out for tapers. The job meant that I was going to have to work in Erie, Pennsylvania. I don't know if any of you have ever been up that far north, but we referred to it as dreary Erie, the mistake on the lake, Pennsylvania. They only have two seasons up there, winter and the 4th of July. Only this time they're getting it. They're hot up there. They blame me for bringing it up. I was up there a couple weeks ago. You're bringing all that heat from the south up. My job looked terrifying to me, so I didn't show up for it. And I had been confronted with the reality myself during the interview process, and I had made up my mind I wasn't going to drink anymore. Wasn't going to do anything anymore. And so 3 days later, I flushed everything that I had down the commode. I mean, I flushed my rig, my drugs, my 151 proof alcohol, everything down that commode. That commode just sort of sat there for 3 weeks going, hey, yeah, whoa. I think that commode, is, you know, coined the phrase, all right. Well, 3 days later, I was sorry I'd done it. And made my mind up. I said, you know, if you can't live drinking, and now you find out you can't live without drinking, it's time to do Hotel California. It's time to check out. I'm tired. I'm 30 years old, and I'm tired. I have given up. I'm just tired. I had this old beat-up car, an alcoholic car. You've seen them. Got a broken spring, sort of leaned down a little bit. Mufflers holding on by baling wire, and radio antennas, a straightened-out coat hanger. And there's a West Virginia window on there. That's just a piece of plastic gaffer taped on there. And keeps the wind and the rain out. You can see through it at night, see lights coming anyhow, and the only trouble, anything over 35 miles an hour, it starts, you think you're inside a snare drum, and but it was mine, and I was going to take it out on the highway, out on Interstate 90, and commit suicide. Going to run into a bridge abutment. Had it all planned out. You ever notice alcoholics, when they're going to commit suicide, fantastic planning, organization. I mean, just a checkoff list, you know, just going right down to it. I never got to the part that said, fill up the gas tank, so I ran out of gas. Oh, yeah, that's funny. Ho, ho, ho. You should have been there that morning. I mean, it's like you can't even pull a suicide off, let alone... get out. You're a failure as a son. You're a failure as a student. Failure as a friend, a husband, a father, an employee, a member of the community. I didn't quite fail at the Marine Corps, but they didn't want me to stay. And I had one of those valuable MOSs, and nobody said, John, we'd like to have you stay because you have a valuable SOS. Or whatever it was, and he said, this officer that was supposed to ask me to stay said, if you hurry, you can make that last bus to Jacksonville, and I did. Now, it took me 5 months to come from Jacksonville, North Carolina, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I got lost a couple times on the way home. And that's the kind of life I had. I was just a failure. Some guy came by and gave me a gallon of gas. You know, big deal, 16 cents worth. And I went back to town to think about it. What that meant was I was going to find a bar, have a drink, and tell the bartender how the world had victimized me again. How they had done it to me again. I was telling somebody one time in A&A that I was a victim, and they said, no, you were a volunteer. Somebody, you know, somebody would say, we got some terrible consequences over here. Oh, that's for me. I'm gonna get in on that. I was not even a real good alcoholic because I didn't have enough blackouts. If I'd had more blackouts, I wouldn't have had such a long fourth and fifth step. I could have said, I don't remember. It sounded like a politician. Oh, I don't know. I don't remember. Is there a governing authority on that? I don't remember. What do you mean by that? But I was just this failure. And I went to a bar that was closed, and I couldn't think to go next door or either way or around the corner. I was out in the West End area where the motto out there is booze, broads, and beds. And I couldn't even think to go next door. And all I could think of was I watched a man get sober when I was 8 years old. Nobody told me what happened to him. He just changed. I went to school with his children. They changed. Everything changed at that house. Instead of stealing money from me when I was collecting, he now gave me a tip every week. Here, kid, keep the change. Never knew what happened to him until, 8 or 10, 12 years later. I was at a cocktail party. This man was there, and my drinking buddy said, you see Rudy over there? And I said, yeah, how can you not see him? He doesn't have a drink. Alcoholics notice things like that. He's not drinking. There's something wrong. He says he belongs to that A&A, and they won't let him drink. My thought was, how cruel can a group of people be? I probably had a drink for him that, you know, here's one for you, Rudy. But now it's 22 years after he got sober, and I'm standing there in front of that bar, and there's a payphone. And I knew that he belonged to that A&A, and they wouldn't let him drink. And I thought, maybe I can call them people. Now, in the back, I don't want to sound too altruistic here, because in the back of my mind, there was a bar down on the waterfront in Erie that had my sign in it. It said, resignations from Alcoholics Anonymous accepted here. So I knew if I went down and got in with y'all that if I didn't like it, I could go over there and resign. And that was my sort of escape clause, loophole. But I went down there, I put on my cleanest, dirty clothes. Men do that, you know. They pick things up and go, I can wear that. This is good for another day. It's manly. And I went down there, I had my cleanest, dirty clothes on. Now, I tell people I parallel parked across the street from the AA office, looked both ways, walked across the street, and said, gentlemen, let's start this AA thing. That's my story. My sponsor was standing at the window, and he said, you jumped the curb, bumped into a parking meter, fell out of the broken door, pulled yourself up by the coat hanger antenna, and you did not walk across the street, you just leaned forward and vibrated. Somewhere between those is the real story, and Paul Harvey will have to pick up on that. First thing they said to me was, would you like a cup of coffee? I don't drink coffee, never have drank coffee, and as far as I'm concerned, you know what you can do with coffee. Just don't make it. I've seen people badly addicted to coffee. I mean, really badly addicted. I got one friend, if he can't find a cup of coffee, he'll take a teaspoon of instant coffee and put it right in his mouth. Suck it up. He's sick. And he don't go to meetings, you know. He's just sick. Get this. Styrofoam had not been invented yet. There was no plastic cups or anything like that. No styrofoam. They handed me an old China mug with a jug ear handle, and that thing was lipping full of coffee, and I hadn't had anything for 4 days. Plus, I should mention, when I was drinking, I was no longer afraid. I'm not drinking again. I'm back being shy and bashful and fearful. They handed me that cup right on the ceiling. And it was like, it just sort of dripped the rest of the afternoon. They said, you come over here and sit down. We'll bring coffee to you. Okay. And they'd bring about this much in the bottom of that mug and told me to use two hands, and I'd bring it up there and sound like castanets in a Spanish dance company. It was bouncing off my teeth, what teeth I had left. Did you ever notice that street bum alcoholics, dental hygiene is real far down the daily priority list, you know? I had so many cavities, I talked with an echo. These old-timers, I'm going to quote from a friend of mine right now, they must have read the big book. They must have really read that chapter on working with others, because that's what they did. They told me in detail, they relived the horror of their past. They told me what they had been like, what happened to them, and what they were like now. And they didn't pull punches or mince words on it. They told me the nitty-gritty of their lives. And I compared myself to them, and some of them I thought, wow, I never did that. And others, if that's all the bullshit was for me, I'd still be out there. You know, there were some people that, might have spilled a drink on their shoes one day and came to AA. Not me. And there was an old-timer, I need to point out, I walked into this A&A place, and it looked like God's waiting room. There wasn't anybody. I mean, they were all old, 45, 55, 65 years old. It was God's waiting room. They were waiting. God would say, next, and one of them would go on up. I'm 30 years old. I'm a hippie. I'd been a beatnik. Now I'm a hippie. I've got long red hair to the shoulders. I've got a beard almost to the belt. I looked like a ZZ Top album cover. I had peace signs hanging on me and Make Love, Not War painted on my Levi jacket. And I didn't want you to think I was a wuss, so I had my Marine Corps medals right here too. You know, let you know that you weren't dealing with one of those. They'd never seen a beatnik up close before, or smelled one up close, maybe. But they were kind. And this one old-timer came over to me and he says, kid, judging by what you've heard here today, do you think you're an alcoholic? Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I am. Do you want to do something about it? Yes. Yes. Under my breath, I said, "What? Listen, dummy, that's why I'm here." I never said that out loud. No, I knew better than that. Then he almost lost me. He said, do you believe in God? Well, I went to that Bible-thumping college and was brought up that way, and I knew what he wanted to hear, so I said, yeah, I believe there's a God. And he said, good. Those are the first three steps. We'll start on your inventory tomorrow morning. I haven't seen a big book yet. I haven't seen nothing hanging on the walls that has steps on them or anything like that. So I wasn't sure what we were talking about, but I thought to myself, well, the magic's still here. I don't know nothing, and I've got three right already. Went to my first A&A meeting that night, and I found out there were 12 steps, and I said, I've got 25% of this program down pat. And as soon as they give me the melody, I can pick it up and run with it. I'll have this thing by Wednesday next week. Take the weekend off, and I'll be ready. Boy, I wish I was that naive still. And that was on May 1st, 1968. And it was not 5 weeks later that I was at my first Founders Day in Akron. And I was being introduced to people whose stories were in the original Big Book. I was being introduced to people who I recognized as nationally known entertainers and politicians. And it was like, Shazam, if these people got my problem, I must be okay. I identified right away, you know. I wanted to be famous. I always wanted to be famous. I am now, but it's under an assumed name. Ho, ho, ho. That was 5 weeks into the program. I was at Founders Day. A couple weeks after that, I was at Cook Forest Conference, reputed to be one of the oldest conferences in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's some argument and doubt on that, but I live near there, so it must be true. And there was a little old lady who had hair as red as mine. Hers was dyed, and she came over and she liked me. And she said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, yes, Bill D. right over there. And she said, do you have an alternate sponsor? And I said, R.D. right there. And she goes, good, I know them both, and you have good sponsorship. But I want to make sure that you get what this program has to offer. I am your godmother in AA. And she's passed now, so I can use her name. Her name is Ann Craw. And she wrote the 12 rewards to the 12-step program, something you don't do down here. We still do it a little bit up north. You know, things like hope instead of desperation, peace of mind instead of despair, the love and understanding of her family and friends instead of their pity and contempt. There's 12 of them. They're beautiful. And she was a beautiful little old lady, and she just tucked me under her wing and made sure that I got everything this program had to offer. One time she said to me at Founders Day, she said, don't go home, come to the house. And I said, Ann, I'm going to the dance. She said, don't go to the dance, don't go home, come to the house. I did not want to come to the house. It'd just be a 100-mile round trip from my place to the house. And she said, I want you at the house tonight. All right. And I went over, and her Al-Anon husband opened the door and said, they're in the kitchen. I don't know what his resentment was, but they're in the kitchen. And I went out to the kitchen. There was Moses Yoder, Paul Rock, Warren Chisholm, Ann, and some guy from New York named Bill Wilson. It's a round kitchen table, and Ann told me, sit down and be quiet. So I don't think that I was aware then of how important that was. Because I'd met him a couple times before, but I never had had time just to sit and listen. And he was dying of COPD and congestive heart failure. And every now and then he'd take the oxygen hose out of his nose and turn the oxygen tank off and light up another cigarette. And we didn't think anything of it because we all smoked. There was a book about us at that time. It was called Caffeine, Nicotine, and God. And the premise was to get sober, you smoked cigarettes, drank coffee, and talked about God, and everything else fell in place. I'm looking for a copy of that book right now. I can't find it. Any of you eBayites, find it. I want one. I had reservations, though. I did not buy into your program because I couldn't get honest. There were things that... It's like my first inventory. The guy said to me, he says, what's the worst thing you ever did? And I'm thinking, I can't tell you because the statute of limitations hasn't run out on it yet. And the other ones were too embarrassing to talk about, so I finally got down to something I could talk about. I did the worst fifth step I've ever heard or seen done. But it was successful in this. It blunted the edge of the desire to drink. It didn't do me any positive good, but it cut off the negative. Terrible fifth step. Which meant that I didn't have any foundation to go in 6 and 7, and I wasn't changing. There was no change in my life. And my sponsor said to me, he said, don't go home. I'm always getting people say, don't go home tonight. We're going to Cleveland. I want you to hear this man from Eatontown, New Jersey. His name's Alan Gallagher, and he's got a great talk, and you need to hear it. So we drove the 110 miles to Erie. I listened to Alan Gallagher, and he was from Eatontown, New Jersey. He talked like New Jersey, and oh, God, it was terrible. And I'm thinking, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll get home, and I got to be at work at 8. You know, and I got to listen to somebody from New Jersey. My ex-wife was from New Jersey, I know. At the end of his talk, he said, I submit to you that it is easier to act yourself into proper thinking than to think yourself into proper acting. Sponsor tried to break his elbow on my ribs. Did you get that? Oh, yes. Yes. And we talked about that all the way home. Did you understand what Mr. Gallagher from Eatontown, New Jersey had to say tonight? Yes, yes, I did. And this went on and on and on. And I finally blurted out what was in my head. I said, Bill, you don't have to tell me about this because this is something I have done all my life. Oh, the car went off the road. Lights went off. Ignition was turned off. Finger went up in the air. Thought I was out an Allen on me. No, you haven't. You've been pretending to be something in order to fool us. We want you to act like something in order to become it. What an order. Can't go through with it. And then, because I really wasn't sold on what you were doing, I saw a poster one day. Let me step back here. I was tending bar. This is my first job sober, bartending. Not in a nice place either. It's a skid row dump. It's my kind of people. I saw this poster and it said, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I said to myself, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And it wasn't too far from Erie. It was, you know, maybe a 7 or 8 hour hitchhiking run. So I hitchhiked up to Woodstock and hung out with a couple hundred thousand of my closest friends and took advantage of the smokers and dopers. Women. I've got a thing about women. I just love them. And that was a fun weekend, and I got home. My sponsor said, where you been? I said, I've been to Woodstock. And he says, is that stuff I'm watching on television? Yeah. Let me tell you about it. Watershed in the music business. And he says, hold that thought. Your new sponsor might want to hear it. I got fired for going to Woodstock. I got fired from a lot of things. I got a new sponsor, and he got a little too close. And I moved to Pittsburgh, and I got me a class sponsor down in Pittsburgh. A person that everybody loved. I mean, he looked like everyone's grandfather or uncle. And he was like that until we were alone. And then he got absolutely nasty. He said, "How long did you say you were sober?" And I told him, he said, "Doesn't seem that way. Let's work the steps." Well, I moved to West Virginia the next day. And I became the business manager of a therapeutic treatment center for alcoholics and drug addicts. And through attrition and stupidity, I became the managing director of this place. And I was the head sicko at a sick, sick place. And people were getting well and leaving, and they were going home talking about me. And they had an intervention on me. They nebbed in my business. They fired me from a job, evicted me from my apartment, and packed my bags and took my company car away from me and put me on an airplane, sent me to treatment. Almost 2 years without a drink or a drug, and I'm in treatment. I'm neither fish nor fowl. I've recently been a professional in the drug alcohol business, and now I'm a patient, and the patients don't trust me because they're looking at me and going, if this is what 2 years of sobriety looked like, maybe we were in the wrong place. And they were not nice to me in treatment. I went to a place called Chit Chat Farms. You know, there's my friend Barbara down there. She works at Talbot. And you got used to have Bronner's and Rigid View and you know, when I worked at Rigid View for 7 years, they didn't appreciate it then either. But I went to Chit Chat. And I don't care what they call the name, it worked. They confronted me with the reality of myself so long and so hard that I became exhausted. I could no longer defend by lying or attacking. And I blurted out truth. I took an hour and 45 minute catharsis type fourth and fifth step. I told everything. I told about stealing money from my daughter's piggy bank. I told about a murder I had committed and was never caught. I told about a robbery that I had committed and was never caught. These things had been bothering me for years, but I could drink them away, but now I couldn't drink them away. And I came home from treatment and, for God's sakes, got a job with mental health, mental retardation. But when I left treatment, some very wise, wonderful men at that treatment center said, "John, you have grave emotional and mental disorders that you don't have time, and AA doesn't have the ability to work out with you. We want you to stay in treatment." And I stayed in treatment for 17 months. And I worked through these issues. But I had to sit down with my sponsor one time and said, "This murder is eating my lunch." And he said, "I've never killed anybody. Let's get a killer in here." And strangely enough, there are some killers in AA. And he says, let's bring a AA criminal lawyer and we'll talk this out. And the end result was, it was up to me, live with it or put my toothbrush in my pocket and go turn myself in. And I made the decision to go turn myself in. And one of the last things my sponsor said to me was, "Let's hope you get sent to Rockview Penitentiary rather than Western Penitentiary, because the AA meeting is better at Western or Rockview. And he says, you got enough time, you'd be chairman first week. And I sort of had a resentment on that, but I look back on it now. If you're going to prison, what better prison to go to than the one with the good AA? So I went. And I won't go into a long, long story here, but I copped the plea. And I had done this murder in a reform school. And the warden was a new warden. He didn't remember it. He looked it up. He asked me to wait. He called a judge and another lawyer. This is a privately owned reform school, so the owners were judges and lawyers. And they came. And then he had the wisdom to call two local AA members and ask them to sit in on this discussion. And I'm in a locked room by myself. I didn't know it was locked, but by God it was. I wasn't going anywhere. And they called me back in, and the two AA members just quizzed my buns. They took an inventory. They asked me everything. They wanted to know what kind of program I had. And then I'm back in the room again, and an hour later, the warden came. Everybody was gone but him. And he said, you're going to walk out of here free. Nothing will be done. He said, we're in awe of you for coming and telling on yourself. And he said, the AA members liked what you've been doing. So you're free. You get a reprieve like that. And I said to myself, this is about the last time I'm ever going to darken the door of this reform school for any reason at all. And 8 or 10 years later, they picked up some videos of me teaching cooking. And the warden called me up and he says, I think you owe me a favor. He said, I'd like to have you come down for a week and teach culinary arts at the reform school. And I said, but I have to be able to leave every day. He says, okay. My nephew works in that reform school now. And every now and then when I'm home, I go out and go to the kitchen and we cook a meal. It's a lot of fun. I've really stretched that out. I'm sorry. Sponsor and I went over to Cleveland. We listened to Alan Gallagher from Eatontown, New Jersey. That impressed me so much that I incorporated act yourself into proper thinking rather than think yourself into proper acting into my lecture series at Peachford and Rigid View and everywhere else I've ever worked. And always gave Alan Gallagher from Eatontown, New Jersey credit. And life went on. And I began to do this stuff. I had another teacher one time who explained honesty to me, which I needed to have explained. It's very simple. Honesty is three things. If it is not yours, don't pick it up. If it is not true, don't say it. And if it is not right, don't do it. And when he explained that, I said, yes, but. He says, no, John, no yes, buts. This is concrete. Get the abstracts out of here. Don't steal, don't lie, don't do bad. And if you do, make amends. I hate to make amends. 10 steps, just eat my lunch. A lot of times I want to do something and I think to myself, no, I'm going to have to go give that dumb bum a 10-step and I ain't going to do it, so I just don't do it. I go outside and I spit and grass never grows there again, but it's okay. Another thing that was told me when I was first in the program, I should have taken this one to the bank. Don't drink. Don't smoke them left-handed cigarettes. Go to meetings. Find and use a sponsor. Study and practice the 12 steps. Boy, is that simple, and I need it simple. No abstracts for me. I need sharp directions, and those are it. Those seven little things have saved me a lot of trouble. They've got me into situations where it's just unbelievable how wonderful it came out. As you might look at me and realize, I bear a striking resemblance to a very famous elf, the big elf. And other people noticed this, and one woman came up to me on the street and said, "How big are you?" I don't tell people how big I am, especially in those days. And I told her a lie, and she said, "Well, I have a Santa Claus suit that will fit you. Could you be Santa Claus this weekend?" And I said, "Honey, in case you didn't notice, the beard is bright red." She said, "I can fix that." So I'm out Santa Claus in that first weekend. And I'm naive. I did not realize that there were big, big Santa Claus companies. I mean, big Santa Claus companies. And they have scouts. And I got scouted by one of the big companies. And a few days later, I got a phone call. "Hey, we'd like to have you on the team." And I go, "Excuse me?" And I said, "You know, I have a job." She said, "Well, I already talked to your boss, and you can get away." That's always reassuring, you know. And I said, "Well, I'm really not interested. I knew that around where I was, Santa Claus has got thanks and maybe a couple bucks for gas." And she said, "I need a Santa Claus tomorrow morning in just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, by 10 o'clock. I said, "Well, that's nice." And she said, "You're in a bank right now. I was catering a party in a bank." And I said, "Yeah, I'm in a bank. You called me here at the bank." And she said, "Put the banker on the phone." And a few minutes later, the banker came out of his office and he said, "There's $1,000 being wired here if you will go to Cleveland tomorrow morning." Ho, ho, ho. I mean, I'm your boy. Stripped out the beard that night, woke up a friend of mine who's a cosmetologist. She stripped and bleached my hair, had me on the road, and I was in Cleveland at 9:45. Guy standing there saying, "You must be Santa Claus." "Yeah, you got it." And I had that $1,000 in my pocket, and he said, "Let's get dressed and get after it." And I said, "Is there anything I need to know?" And he said, "Play it by ear." I said, "Okay." Those were easy days. Now to get to be a Santa Claus, you have to pass a drug test, a lie detector test, a background check. I was a law enforcement officer, and I didn't go through a background check as bad as this one was, for just to be Santa Claus. They're really sort of, and plus I carry $1 million liability while I'm in a Santa Claus suit. If I drop your kid, it's worth $1 million. I don't drop kids. I've had them slide off me, but I don't drop them. This first Santa Claus job, guy comes up, got two little boys, they tell me what they want for Christmas. They're leaving. The old man turns around, looks at me, and he says, "No milk and cookies at my place. I'm going to leave you beef jerky and beer." I don't have a governor on my mouth, so I said, "Oh, no thanks, I go to meetings." It was like E.F. Hutton had just spoken. I mean, the atrium and the mezzanine just went. One of my elves is in AA. She goes, "Oh, God." I mean, it's just dead silent. And the little boy pulled his daddy's hand and said, "Uh-oh, Dad, he's in the program." Dad's standing there, and he goes, I said, how long you been on the slip? 5 months. About time to do something, isn't it? Can I talk to you? No. There are 300 kids waiting to see me. You go home, call your sponsor, go to a meeting. Back to business. Next morning, three-piece suit walks up to the Santa set and says, come here, Santa. I walk over. He said, I thought you'd like to know. He said he called his sponsor. He went to a meeting. He picked up a white chip. And he told everybody that Santa Claus had 12-stepped him. I'm very biblical about that. I do not hide this light under a bushel. You want to know why I'm happy? I'm sober. In AA. And I go to an AFG meeting every now and then just to touch base with reality. You know, when you get to believe in your own press notices, it's time to go to somewhere where they'll work on the Sister Ignatia theory of how can you ever be humble unless you've been humiliated? I got married again, thinking to myself, the reason that first marriage failed is because I was drinking. And now this one will be okay. Wrong. It damn near had me drinking again. Roy Clark's song, Thank God and Greyhound, that big diesel engine's playing my song, Thank God and Greyhound, she's gone. You know, she and I are very good friends now. And her first ex-husband is sort of a friend of mine because I 12-stepped him. He wanted to compare notes on the marriage. I said, no, we're not here about that. We're here about getting sober and quit kicking them kids. I did very well for the Santa Claus company, and they gave me beautiful locations. They gave me Avenue U and Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. I'm going to tell you something. If you're Santa Claus in Brooklyn, New York, you had better be sure that you found an early morning AA meeting and a late at night AA meeting. Because them parents will drive you crazy. Kids are wonderful. And I was real near Brighton Beach, which is a very heavy Jewish neighborhood, and I had a lot of children come up and look both ways, sit on my lap and say, Santa, I'm not Christian. And I'd go, well, you have a Hanukkah bush? Yeah, let's go. Tell me what you want, real quick. I just love kids. I had this happen last year. I still get up on it. I was walking through the mall in Altamont Springs, Florida, and an obviously Muslim family was coming toward me. And in the center of the family was probably a 14 or 15-year-old who was obviously severely handicapped. And he broke away from his family, and he came and threw his arms around my neck and hugged me and made noises. You want to see sort of a dichotomy of what to do. I didn't want to push a child away, but his family wasn't really thrilled about their kid slobbering over a Santa Claus. And the father finally started forward, and I looked at him and I said, Inshallah, it's the will of your God. Then we all cried and left. In 1996, I was 28 years sober, 29 years out of that divorce that if they could have given the death penalty, they would have given it to me. 29 years out of that divorce that said, you will never, ever be even in the same county with any member of this family. And I'm sitting, Santa Claus, in Eatontown, New Jersey, where Alan Gallagher was from. That's why I chose that. They offered me several locations, and I said, I want to go where Mr. Gallagher's from. I chose that location because of an AA thing 28 years before. And a woman came and sat on my lap. And I said, what's your name, honey? And she said, you know what my name is, Daddy. This was the daughter that I was court-ordered never to see, never to contact, never to know. She lived less than 4 miles from the mall. My niece had called her and said, your dad's over at the Monmouth Mall. If you ever want to see him, now's the time. Mr. Gallagher didn't know what he was doing that night. My sponsor didn't know. I didn't know. Everybody since then that had helped me, because I've always, that was always in the back of my mind, God, I'd like to be a father to my own children. And it happened. God gave it to me when I was ready for it, when I desperately needed it. And it was like a dipping and healing service. And I called my friends. And we were praising God and crying all over the map. That's to me, that's the moment, the defining moment of my recovery, was that God let me have a daughter back. And we're not father-daughter, never will be. But we are good friends, and we have some laughs. I went to make a nine-step amends to her, and she said, don't bother. I said, yeah, I got to. She said, I know. I belong to one of them 12-step programs, too. And I owe you some. Let's just call it a wash and just say. And just say, I love you. And I care. David mentioned this morning that we lost a longtime AA member. I moved to Atlanta in late January, early February of 1981. And I moved into a condominium with three other guys. And one of them was Don Phillips. And Don was brand new in the program, and just, he's full of punk and vinegar. And he was an egotist, and I hate egotists because I am one. I recognized him right away, and I said, we got to deflate this ego. But he's been a good friend for 25 years. And he just dumped the motorcycle yesterday, and that's, knowing Don, he probably would have chosen that way to go out. He was a hellraiser. He had this idea that life was here to live, and I'm going to live it. And I'm going to miss him. Indulge me, because I need to remember this every now and then. This is in the Grapevine, Best of the Grapevine, Volume 1, page 80, whatever, 81. I've had 7 eye operations in the last couple months. Got one more to go. I'm lucky I'm still driving. That's because I won't go take the damn test. Down at the bottom of the social scale of AA society are the pariahs, the untouchables, and the outcasts. all underprivileged and all known by one excoriating epitaph, the relatives. I am a relative. I know my place. I'm not complaining. But I hope no one will mind if I venture the plaintive confession that there are times, oh many times, when I wish I had been an alcoholic. By that I mean I wish I were an AA. The reason is that I consider the AA people the most charming in the world. Such is my considered opinion. As a journalist, this was written by Fulton Ausler, editor and publisher of Liberty Magazine, and also author of the biography of Christ called The Greatest Story Ever Told. I have found it my fortune to meet many of the people who are considered charming. I number among my friends stars and lesser lights of stage and cinema. Writers are my daily diet. I know the ladies and gentlemen of both political parties. I have been entertained in the White House. I have broken bread with kings and ministers and ambassadors. And I say after that catalog that I would prefer an evening with my AA friends to an evening with any person or group of persons I have indicated. I ask myself why I consider so charming these alcoholic caterpillars who have found their butterfly wings in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are more reasons than one, but I can name a few. The AA people are what they are, and they were what they were because they are sensitive, imaginative, and possessed of a sense of humor and an awareness of universal truth. They are sensitive, which means that they are hurt easily, and that helped them become alcoholics. But when they have found their restoration, they are still as sensitive as ever, responding to beauty and to truth, and eager about the intangible glories of life. That makes them charming companions. They are imaginative, and that helped to make them alcoholics. Some of them drank to flog their imaginations on to greater efforts. Others guzzled only to black out unendurable visions that rose in their imaginations. But when they have found their restoration, their imagination is responsive to new incantations, and their talk abounds with color and light. And that makes them charming companions, too. They are possessed of a sense of humor. Even in their cups, they've been known to say some damnably funny things. Often, it was being forced to take seriously the little and mean things of life that made them seek escape in the bottle. But when they have found their restoration, their sense of humor finds a blessed freedom, and they are able to reach a godlike state where they can laugh at themselves, the very height of self-conquest. Go to the meetings and listen to the laughter. At what are they laughing? At ghoulish memories that would make lesser souls cringe in useless remorse. And that makes them wonderful people to be with by candlelight. And they are possessed of a sense of universal truth. That is often a new thing in their hearts. The fact that this at one moment with God's universe had never been awakened in them is sometimes the reason they drank. The fact that it was at last awakened is almost always the reason that they were restored to the good and simple way of life. Stand with them when the meeting is over and listen as they say the Lord's Prayer. They have found a power greater than themselves, which they diligently serve. And that gives them a charm gives a charm that never was elsewhere on land or sea. It makes you know that God Himself is charming, because the AA people reflect His mercy and His forgiveness. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for asking me. I love you.